Good morning, everyone. This morning will be different from the usual St. Alfred's sermon. I wonder if you have ever been on a journey and then tried to describe to someone what that journey was like and how to get to the destination. I've been doing that with MPs and with others over the last 9 months. The journey I've been describing is the journey of serious and terminal illness. What can happen on that journey, and the various ways of navigating to the destination, including the false paths and the best path to follow. That is what this assisted suicide debate is about. The best way to get to a destination, and if changing the law is the best way, or whether there are alternatives. I want to talk this morning about several aspects of this: the journey for the patient, family and staff, the proposed legislation, some things about the environment of ideas that we find ourselves in at the moment, the relevance of a Christian worldview, and I want to introduce you to some of the people who are affected. So, what is severe illness like for the patient, the family, and the staff? For the patient, the experience is very individual. There may be little distress apart from a lack of energy, but some people have pain, depression, anxiety, fears of dependency, nausea, feeling a burden, all shaped by the person's own individual temperament and personality features. For the family, they may be supportive, but not always. There may be conflict, there may be misunderstandings about illness and treatment, sometimes wishes for early inheritance, intolerance, impatience, sometimes mixed feelings about the person from old grievances. A part of you can want the person to go on living, and a part of you can want the whole experience to be over as quickly as possible. And I've experienced that myself with my father, who died a few years ago. For the staff may be skilled and knowledgeable and insightful, or not so much. They may be unempathic, intolerant, ignorant of the knowledge and the skills that are required for managing someone in this phase of their life. And then there is the interaction between those three groups. This is psychological soup. It is the skill of the palliative care physician and the liaison psychiatrist to elicit people's beliefs, their symptoms, their feelings, to quickly assess personality types, to be aware of the issues for each person and each group of people. You kind of map it in your mind and look at recommending the best path to navigate for the journey ahead. So, what are the key criteria that are proposed in this legislation for a person to be eligible, is the terminology that's used, for assisted suicide? Well, one has to be an Australian citizen, resident in Victoria for over 18 years. Someone would have to have said that you have less than 12 months of life expected. The person must believe that they have no acceptable treatment. A desire for assisted suicide has to be expressed 3 times. 2 doctors have to sign off that the person fulfills the criteria, who must be mentally competent to make decisions. A fatal dose is dispensed as a takeaway by the person or a nominated person, but it leaves the door open to intravenous injection by the doctor as a possibility. And this whole exercise is only reviewed after the person has died. Some people think that this sounds compassionate at first sight and that it must be okay if the guidelines are safe and it doesn't affect anyone else. But we must take a closer look at this. Are the guidelines actually safe? Does a law change affect the care of other people? The arguments given in support of this kind of legislation are essentially 2. One is suffering and the other is autonomy. Let us look at suffering first. This is the kind of selling point for this policy, but is it a half-truth? Palliative care is a very young specialty. There are several centres of excellence in Melbourne, both inpatient and in home-based. And these have very few requests for euthanasia because their symptom control is very good. In other places, there may be poor care, poor medication management, poor counselling, more symptoms. Many cases in the submission put to the Parliamentary Committee are very old. The oldest of them is 60 years ago, before modern palliative care even existed. There has been inadequate education, though, of doctors and nurses in palliative care, which has led to patchy care. At the risk of quoting an American politician, which is particularly a risk at the moment, I think, some healthcare professionals don't know what they don't know. There's also a lot of misunderstanding in the community about illness and about symptom control, myths about cancer in particular. All cancer patients have pain, it is said. Some do, but not all. Cancer pain cannot be treated, some people believe. Not true. Management depends very much on the specific cause. It includes radiotherapy sometimes, may include palliative chemotherapy, may include oral medication, subcutaneous medication. If necessary, palliative sedation, where a person is rendered unconscious, necessary in a very small percentage of people. There is a video circulating in social media by the Go Gentle group, the Denton group, that some of you may have seen, which raises a lot of questions. It's said to be an acted representation of the death of a man some 13 years ago in pain, which was poorly controlled and with convulsions, and the implication is given that this poor death is typical. But there are lots of questions raised with a case such as that. If there were problems, was he referred to a palliative care physician for an opinion and management? Did the family or he refuse recommendations? Were the family involved in regular counselling? Was he having some palliative treatment? Why was his pain not adequately controlled? I would challenge anyone to visit a proper palliative care unit and see if there are people there crying out with uncontrolled pain. I doubt that you will find them. But is pain the real issue? Often it's not. A desire for autonomy and choice seems to be the driving factor. Recent research in Canada, where assisted suicide is legal, shows that most people do not request assisted suicide because of pain control. They request because of a desire to have control over the situation. So in the assisted suicide process that this legislation outlines, there is actually no proper clinical assessment. There is no treatment of distress or suffering. There is no obligation for a trial of palliative treatment. It is very difficult to detect coercion by family or other people, which may be subtle and just by attitude. The autonomy and preference for choice for some individuals must be balanced by the common good of the community, the effects of a law change on the medical care of others. The desire for autonomy and control is part of the soil from which this proposal arises. I try to do some gardening from time to time, and when you garden, you come to see that the main factor in whether plants thrive or not is the soil. Similarly, this proposal comes from a certain type of soil, a soil of ideas. We need to understand the soil of ideas current in the community at the moment. This is Professor Margaret Somerville, Professor of Law and Bioethics at McGill University in Canada, the founding director of the McGill Centre for Medicine, Ethics and Law. She's an Australian, and on return to Australia recently, she's appointed Professor of Bioethics in Sydney. She has opposed this legislation in Canada and has written helpfully about the soil of ideas. She writes, and I quote, "Assisted suicide is the tip of an enormous iceberg of change in individual and societal values, involving rejection of traditional values and views, and a utopianism, a belief that the sought-after change will only do good, but also a blindness to its risks and harms, and the espousing of ideology of individual choice. This intense individualism has led to individual autonomy and choice becoming the dominant value in Canada and in Western democracies, trumping other values in most situations." End of her quote. In assisted suicide, there's also been a long-standing campaign of euphemisms and corruption of language, encouragement of fears about the end of life, and the blaming of all opposition on religious faith. This attitudinal soil leads to several problems. It leads to a difficulty in seeing the consequences, a difficulty in thinking through public policy and discerning the principles at work. The claimed rights and choice are perceived as trumping everything else. Part of the attitudinal soil is a distrust of experts, an attitude that my opinion is as good as anyone's. An opinion about any subject is only of value if it's an informed opinion, if the person actually knows something about the issue. There's also been a media adoption of trendy causes. The Melbourne Age has taken an editorial position in favour of assisted suicide, and it's been virtually impossible in the last 2 years to get any balanced view printed. However, the Herald Sun just yesterday printed an editorial opposing this legislation, calling it a step too far and advocating palliative care development as the priority. So how can MPs go about forming an opinion and voting? Some people think that the euthanasia issue is one which just concerns an individual, but changing the law changes it for everyone, and it has unforeseen consequences. MPs have an obligation to make decisions on the basis of the common good, the effect of a law change on the whole community and the future care of other people. We know there have been some bad deaths in the past, but also much real dying with dignity in good palliative care. Some people leap to a legal solution to problems rather than a clinical solution. The law is a very blunt instrument, and blunt indeed in the complex area of illness and in medical management. What are the problems then with the way assisted suicide, this assisted suicide and euthanasia legislation actually work? Firstly, the so-called safeguards are not safe. Seems to be a bit of a problem. There are 100 oncologists, 100 palliative care physicians, and just this week 100 geriatricians have joined with senior medical and legal academics who have written to MPs stating that this legislation is unsafe and that they oppose it. There is no palliative care assessment, no assessment why a person is having suicidal thought. They just have to believe that any management is intolerable. Next, no doctor can tell you whether you've got 3, 6, or 12 months to live. Doctors refer to like-minded mates. There is, in fact, no independent medical assessment as part of this process. The door is open to doctor shopping. The bill creates an offence of coercion, but you cannot detect coercion by unsupportive attitude. Fatal medicine is also given out into the community unsupervised. I cannot improve on the questions for MPs that have been raised by my colleague Dr. John Daffy, who is a physician at several Melbourne hospitals. He's written a letter to MPs entitled Seven Questions, That Is All. I will read it to you. As an infectious diseases specialist, he says, with 25 years' experience, I have just seven questions. Why is it acceptable that no psychiatrist is involved in the proposed assisted suicide process when depression is notoriously difficult to diagnose and a major driver behind terminally ill patients wanting to die? Why doesn't the model mandate the involvement of a palliative care specialist so the patient can be fully aware of the possibilities before killing themselves? Only palliative care specialists truly know what that superior care can involve. Why is 12 months the defining time? Doctors are actually poor at predicting the time a person has to live. Why is it acceptable that the two doctors signing off on a patient's suicide don't need to be their treating doctor or even inform the treating doctor? Why is it acceptable that there will be no way of knowing the actual circumstances of how the lethal medication will be taken, or indeed if it was taken, or where the drug ends up? Why is it acceptable that under the model, a patient's death certificate, a legal document, will be falsified, recording their illness as the cause of death, as opposed to their suicide? How many errors and intentional wrongful deaths is Parliament happy to accept? If anyone tells you this process is going to be safe, don't believe them. They are not lying, they are just misinformed. Make no mistake, depressed, coerced and vulnerable people will die under this model when they shouldn't. This is a process which cannot be made safe. That's the end of his letter. So what are the main arguments against legislation like this? Firstly, the safeguards are flawed, as I've said. But then there is a group of things which I would call the ripple effect. The criteria for such guidelines always creep, as they have, particularly in the Netherlands and in Belgium. Once you cross the thin red line that doctors do not participate in the taking of life, people want to stretch it. Usually, they claim legally discrimination. The door is open to elder abuse and financial abuse. There develops a duty to die and a confusion of public health messages about suicide. At the end of the day, the suicide potion is cheaper also to bureaucrats. In Oregon, it's called comfort medicine. The clear evidence about what has happened in other countries which have legalised assisted suicide are that the laws and safeguards are regularly ignored and transgressed, and that transgressions are not prosecuted. Evidence also is that assisted suicide is soon changed from a last resort to a first choice option, with people not being given the option of palliative care. Let us meet some of the people who have been involved with this sort of legislation. This is Professor Tom Mortier, Professor of Chemistry. His mother was euthanized without his knowledge. And when he inquired as to why she was euthanized, all that was wrong with her was that she had a grief reaction. She was physically quite well. This is Kate Cheney in Oregon, where this assisted suicide law has been enacted. Her own doctor would not agree with assisted suicide and wouldn't sign off on it. He thought her daughter was coercing her. She was referred to a psychologist, and the psychologist agreed. She thought that the daughter was coercing her also. However, she doctor shopped, and the patient was still euthanized. This is Jeanette Hall in Oregon. She had cancer. She refused treatment and wanted assisted suicide. She had actually voted for it. But she saw a second oncologist. Over several sessions, she decided that she would have treatment. She was treated, treatment was very successful, and she's alive and well 13 years later after she would have chosen assisted suicide. In the Netherlands, a little while ago, there was a case which has been very well reported of a female Dutch doctor. There was a lady who was in a nursing home, and she had apparently mentioned at some point that she might put up her hand for assisted suicide. And one day the doctor said, oh, today's the day. So she got the person's family in, she put some drugs in the woman's coffee and then asked her family to hold her down. The woman complained and said, no, I don't wish to do this. And the family actually held her down while she was given an intravenous injection and euthanized. This is Dr. Chabot. Dr. Chabot regrets. He was an early adopter. In 1993, in the Netherlands, he euthanized a woman who had depression only. She was physically quite well. He's regarded as a grandfather of euthanasia in the Netherlands. He is now appalled at the rapid increase in euthanasia death in the Netherlands. And this is what he's appalled at, the steep rise, that slide's actually now a couple of years old, the steep rise of euthanasia deaths that has occurred in the Netherlands, which he thinks is entirely inappropriate. This is Professor Theo Boer, Professor of Ethics in Belgium. He thought initially that this was a good law, and he was involved in a review committee for euthanasia and assisted suicide. But after 12 years of that experience, he came to the view that Belgium had gone down the wrong path. He begged the UK government to reject such legislation, which they did a couple of years ago, quite overwhelmingly. So, what is the relevance of faith to this issue? I have spent some time, you might be surprised to know, encouraging constituents who visited their MPs to not mention religion. Because the view has been put to MPs by others that the only objection to assisted suicide legislation is religion. Particularly the Catholics have had a bad press in this regard. If you make religious talk to MPs, their eyes glaze over and they ignore everything you say. So I have encouraged people who have been going to see MPs to discuss this issue on practical grounds, the grounds like I have outlined to you. But the intersection of faith and assisted suicide comes with the value of people. A key part of the Christian message is obviously that people matter. We're not just economic units, but people made in the image of God and valued. The basis of our legal system and of our healthcare system is the Judeo-Christian concept of the value of persons. This is Dr. Cicely Saunders at St. Christopher's Hospice in London. She is Dame Cicely Saunders, the originator of hospice care, the concept of an integrated form of care, physical, psychological, social, and spiritual. It has become known in recent years as palliative care rather than hospice care, a style of care which can be used both in inpatients, as in hospices, but also used in the community as well. That is the constructive Christian response. Cicely Saunders was a remarkable woman. She was an Anglican who started as a social worker but thought that it would be more useful that she should become a nurse, then a doctor, then a physician, and then developed hospice palliative care. She's a Protestant saint, in my opinion. We should note that most jurisdictions around the world have rejected this legislation, most recently in the UK, quite overwhelmingly, in New Zealand, been rejected in South Australia, narrowly, more definitely in Tasmania. The World Medical Association regards assisted suicide and euthanasia as unethical. Palliative Care Victoria opposes it as a formal policy. There is no Australian professional medical organisation that supports it. Someone sent me an email just yesterday saying that the American College of Physicians has come out with a formal policy opposing assisted suicide and euthanasia. This is Dr. Michael Gannon, President of the AMA Federal Australia. The AMA policy is that governments have the right to change laws, but the AMA policy is that doctors should not be involved in this sort of process. It seems to me that the assisted suicide approach is effectively to abandon the patient to a tick box approach, to pass by on the other side, to the detriment of other patients. There is a thin red line of medical ethics that doctors do not kill patients or help them to kill themselves. Once you cross that ethical line of helping patients to kill themselves, it's all downhill. It would be a seismic shift in medical practice. So, my conclusion about this is that legislation for assisted suicide is an attempted legal solution to a very complex medical and psychological problem. On balance, it seems to me it will create more problems than it solves. There are foreseeable consequences of this law change, which are harmful to the community and to the management of future patients. The better solution is rapid expansion of palliative care skills and knowledge. Ultimately, what kind of healthcare system do we want? As Peter mentioned last week, it is not too late to call one of your local MPs. Don't bother calling Robert Clark, who's the member probably for most people here. Robert is definitely going to vote against this bill, I can tell you that. Call an upper house member for the region out here, like Bruce Atkinson or Mary Wooldridge. Let me finish by paraphrasing today's reading with apologies to St. Luke the physician. A lawyer asked Jesus, "Who is my neighbour?" Jesus told a story of a man, let's call him a Victorian, who was very sick. He felt a burden and like he wanted to die. The man's family gave the impression that he was a bit of a nuisance. Visiting him was a burden. He'd reached his use-by date. They'd also checked how his will was written. An ethicist happened to be in the hospital and asked himself, "What use is this man?" He passed by on the other side, down the corridor. A doctor the man had never seen before ignored the man's symptoms and his own medical training, but offered to fill in some forms, tick some boxes, and help the man to take his life instead. But another doctor took pity on him. She understood his suffering and did something to relieve his symptoms. She helped the man and his family to talk things over and offered to accompany him on his journey to the end of his life. Which of these was a neighbour to the man who was ill?